They are important constituents of our mental makeup and vital forces in the building up of human society, and they cannot be eradicated without serious loss. Where they are repressed or neglected, their specific energy disappears into the unconscious with unaccountable consequences. The psychic energy that appears to have been lost in this way, in fact, serves to revive and intensify whatever is uppermost in the unconscious. Tendencies, perhaps, that have hitherto had no chance to express themselves, or at least have not been allowed an uninhibited existence in our consciousness. Such tendencies form an ever-present and potentially destructive shadow to our conscious mind. Even tendencies that might, in some circumstances, be able to exert a beneficial influence are transformed into demons when they are repressed. This is why many well-meaning people are understandably afraid of the unconscious, and, incidentally, of psychology. Our times have demonstrated what it means for the gates of the underworld to be opened. Things whose enormity nobody could have imagined in the idyllic harmlessness of the first decade of our century have happened and have turned our world upside down. Ever since, the world has remained in a state of schizophrenia. Not only has civilized Germany disgorged its terrible primitivity, but Russia is also ruled by it, and Africa has been set on fire. No wonder that the Western world feels uneasy. Modern man does not understand how much his rationalism, which has destroyed his capacity to respond to numinous symbols and ideas, has put him at the mercy of the psychic underworld. He has freed himself from superstition, or so he believes, but in the process he has lost his spiritual values to a positively dangerous degree. His moral and spiritual tradition has disintegrated, and he is now paying the price for this breakup in worldwide disorientation and dissociation. Anthropologists have often described what happens to a primitive society when its spiritual values are exposed to the impact of modern civilization. Its people lose the meaning of their lives, their social organization disintegrates, and they themselves morally decay. We are now in the same condition, but we have never really understood what we have lost, for our spiritual leaders, unfortunately, were more interested in protecting their institutions than in understanding the mystery that symbols present. In my opinion, faith does not exclude thought, which is man's strongest weapon, but unfortunately, many believers seem to be so afraid of science, and incidentally of psychology, that they turn a blind eye to the numinous psychic powers that forever control man's fate. We have stripped all things of their mystery and numinosity. Nothing is holy any longer. In earlier ages, as instinctive concepts welled up in the mind of man, his conscious mind could no doubt integrate them into a coherent psychic pattern. But the civilized man is no longer able to do this. His advanced consciousness has deprived itself of the means by which the auxiliary contributions of the instincts and the unconscious can be assimilated. These organs of assimilation and integration were numinous symbols held holy by common consent. Today, for instance, we talk of matter. We describe its physical properties. We conduct laboratory experiments to demonstrate some of its aspects. But the word matter remains a dry, inhuman, and purely intellectual concept without any psychic significance for us. How different was the former image of matter, the Great Mother, that could encompass and express the profound emotional meaning of Mother Earth. In the same way, what was the spirit is now identified with intellect and thus ceases to be the father of all. It is degenerated to the limited ego thoughts of man. The immense emotional energy expressed in the image of our Father vanishes into the sand of an intellectual desert. These two archetypal principles lie at the foundation of the contrasting systems of East and West. The masses and their leaders do not realize, however, that there is no substantial difference between calling the world principle male and a father, spirit, as the West does, or female and a mother, matter, as the communists do. Essentially, we know as little of the one as of the other. In earlier times, these principles were worshipped in all sorts of rituals, which at least showed the psychic significance they held for man. But now they have become mere abstract concepts. As scientific understanding has grown, so our world has become dehumanized. Man feels himself isolated in the cosmos, because he is no longer involved in nature and has lost his emotional unconscious identity with natural phenomena. These have slowly lost their symbolic implications. Thunder is no longer the voice of an angry god, nor is lightning his avenging missile. No river contains a spirit. No tree is the life principle of a man. No snake the embodiment of wisdom. No mountain cave the home of a great demon. No voices now speak to man from stones, plants, and animals, nor does he speak to them, believing they can hear. His contact with nature has gone, and with it has gone the profound emotional energy that this symbolic connection supplied. This enormous loss is compensated for by the symbols of our dreams. They bring up our original nature, its instincts and peculiar thinking. Unfortunately, however, they express their contents in the language of nature, which is strange and incomprehensible to us. It therefore confronts us with the task of translating it into the rational words and concepts of modern speech, which has liberated itself from its primitive encumbrances, notably from its mystical participation with the things it describes. Nowadays, when we talk of ghosts and other numinous figures, we are no longer conjuring them up. The power, as well as the glory, is drained out of such once potent words. We have ceased to believe in magic formulas. Not many taboos and similar restrictions are left, and our world seems to be disinfected of all such superstitious noumena as witches, warlocks, and worrikus, to say nothing of werewolves, vampires, bush souls, and all the other bizarre beings that populated the primeval forest. To be more accurate, the surface of our world seems to be cleansed of all superstitious and irrational elements. Whether, however, the real inner human world, not our wish-fulfilling fiction about it, is also freed from primitivity is another question. Is the number 13 not still taboo for many people? Are there not still many individuals possessed by irrational prejudices, projections, and childish illusions? A realistic picture of the human mind reveals many such primitive traits and survivals which are still playing their roles just as if nothing had happened during the last 500 years. It is essential to appreciate this point. Modern man is in fact a curious mixture of characteristics acquired over the long ages of his mental development. This mixed-up being is the man and his symbols that we have to deal with, and we must scrutinize his mental products very carefully indeed. Skepticism and scientific conviction exist in him side by side with old-fashioned prejudices, outdated habits of thought and feeling, obstinate misinterpretations, and blind ignorance. Such are the contemporary human beings who produce the symbols we psychologists investigate. In order to explain these symbols and their meaning, it is vital to learn whether their representations are related to purely personal experience or whether they have been chosen by a dream for its particular purpose from a store of general conscious knowledge. Take, for instance, a dream in which the number 13 occurs. The question is whether the dreamer himself habitually believes in the unlucky quality of the number, or whether the dream merely alludes to people who still indulge in such superstitions. The answer makes a great difference to the interpretation. In the former case, you have to reckon with the fact that the individual is still under the spell of the unlucky 13, and therefore will feel most uncomfortable in room 13 in a hotel, or sitting at a table with 13 people. In the latter case, 13 may not mean any more than a discourteous or abusive remark. The superstitious dreamer still feels the spell of 13. The more rational dreamer has stripped 13 of its original emotional overtones. This argument illustrates the way in which archetypes appear in practical experience. They are, at the same time, both images and emotions. One can speak of an archetype only when these two aspects are simultaneous. When there is merely the image, then there is simply a word picture of little consequence. But by being charged with emotion, the image gains numinosity, or psychic energy. It becomes dynamic, and consequences of some kind must flow from it. I am aware that it is difficult to grasp this concept, because I am trying to use words to describe something whose very nature makes it incapable of precise definition. But since so many people have chosen to treat archetypes as if they were part of a mechanical system that can be learned by rote, it is essential to insist that they are not mere names or even philosophical concepts. They are pieces of life itself, images that are integrally connected to the living individual by the bridge of the emotions. That is why it is impossible to give an arbitrary or universal interpretation of any archetype. It must be explained in the manner indicated by the whole life situation of the particular individual to whom it relates. Thus, in the case of a devout Christian, the symbol of the cross can be interpreted only in its Christian context, unless the dream produces a very strong reason to look beyond it. Even then, the specific Christian meaning should be kept in mind. But one cannot say that at all times and in all circumstances, the symbol of the cross has the same meaning. If that were so, it would be stripped of its numinosity, lose its vitality, and become a mere word. Those who do not realize the special feeling tone of the archetype end with nothing more than a jumble of mythological concepts, which can be strung together to show that everything means anything, or nothing at all. All the corpses in the world are chemically identical, but living individuals are not. Archetypes come to life only when one patiently tries to discover why and in what fashion they are meaningful to a living individual. The mere use of words is futile when you do not know what they stand for. This is particularly true in psychology, where we speak of archetypes such as the anima and animus, the wise man, the great mother, and so on. You can know all about the saints, sages, prophets, and other godly men, and all the great mothers of the world, but if they are mere images whose numinosity you have never experienced, it will be as if you were talking in a dream, for you will not know what you are talking about. The mere words you use will be empty and valueless. They gain life and meaning only when you try to take into account their numinosity, that is, their relationship to the living individual. Only then do you begin to understand that their names mean very little, whereas the way they are related to you is all important. The symbol-producing function of our dreams is thus an attempt to bring the original mind of man into advanced or differentiated consciousness, where it has never been before, and where, therefore, it has never been subjected to critical self-reflection. For in ages long past, that original mind was the whole of man's personality. As he developed consciousness, so his conscious mind lost contact with some of that primitive psychic energy. And the conscious mind has never known that original mind, for it was discarded in the process of evolving the very differentiated consciousness that alone could be aware of it. Yet it seems that what we call the unconscious has preserved primitive characteristics that formed part of the original mind. It is to these characteristics that the symbols of dreams constantly refer, as if the unconscious sought to bring back all the old things from which the mind freed itself as it evolved, illusions, fantasies, archaic thought forms, fundamental instincts, and so on. This is what explains the resistance, even fear, that people often experience in approaching unconscious matters. These relict contents are not merely neutral or indifferent. On the contrary, they are so highly charged that they are often more than merely uncomfortable. They can cause real fear. The more they are repressed, the more they spread through the whole personality in the form of a neurosis. It is this psychic energy that gives them such vital importance. It is just as if a man who has lived through a period of unconsciousness should suddenly realize that there is a gap in his memory, that important events seem to have taken place that he cannot remember. Insofar as he assumes that the psyche is an exclusively personal affair, and this is the usual assumption, he will try to retrieve the apparently lost infantile memories. But the gaps in his childhood memory are merely the symptoms of a much greater loss, the loss of the primitive psyche. As the evolution of the embryonic body repeats its prehistory, so the mind also develops through a series of prehistoric stages. The main task of dreams is to bring back a sort of recollection of the prehistoric, as well as the infantile world, right down to the level of the most primitive instincts. Such recollections can have a remarkably healing effect in certain cases, as Freud saw long ago. This observation confirms the view that an infantile memory gap, a so-called amnesia, represents a positive loss, and its recovery can bring a positive increase in life and well-being. Because a child is physically small, and its conscious thoughts are scarce and simple, we do not realize the far-reaching complications of the infantile mind that are based on its original identity with the prehistoric psyche. That original mind is just as much present and still functioning in the child as the evolutionary stages of mankind are in its embryonic body. If the reader remembers what I said earlier about the remarkable dreams of the child who made a present of her dreams to her father, he will get a good idea of what I mean. In infantile amnesia, one finds strange mythological fragments that also often appear in later psychoses. Images of this kind are highly numinous and therefore very important. If such recollections reappear in adult life, they may in some cases cause profound psychological disturbance, while in other people they can produce miracles of healing or religious conversions. Often they bring back a piece of life, missing for a long time, that gives purpose to and thus enriches human life. The recollection of infantile memories and the reproduction of archetypal ways of psychic behavior can create a wider horizon and a greater extension of consciousness, on condition that one succeeds in assimilating and integrating in the conscious mind the lost and regained contents. Since they are not neutral, their assimilation will modify the personality, just as they themselves will have to undergo certain alterations. In this part of what is called the individuation process, which Dr. M. L. von Franz describes in a later section of this book, the interpretation of symbols plays an important practical role, for the symbols are natural attempts to reconcile and unite opposites within the psyche. Naturally, just seeing and then brushing aside the symbols would have no such effect and would merely reestablish the old neurotic condition and destroy the attempt at a synthesis. But unfortunately, those rare people who do not deny the very existence of the archetypes almost invariably treat them as mere words and forget their living reality. When their numinosity has thus illegitimately been banished, the process of limitless substitution begins. In other words, one glides easily from archetype to archetype, with everything meaning everything. It is true enough that the forms of archetypes are to a considerable extent exchangeable, but their numinosity is and remains a fact and represents the value of an archetypal event. This emotional value must be kept in mind and allowed for throughout the whole intellectual process of dream interpretation. It is only too easy to lose this value because thinking and feeling are so diametrically opposed that thinking almost automatically throws out feeling values and vice versa. Psychology is the only science that has to take the factor of value, that is, feeling, into account, because it is the link between physical events and life. Psychology is often accused of not being scientific on this account, but its critics fail to understand